Yours sincerely. Dick immediately picked up the phone on his desk and dialed Sam Cohen's number, hoping he hadn't already left for the day. When Sam picked up his private line, all Dick said was, "Have you come across a lawyer called Andrew Simons?"
"Only by reputation," said Sam. "But then I don't specialize in divorce."
"Divorce?" said Dick,
as he heard a car coming up the gravel driveway. He glanced out of the window to see a Volkswagen swing round the circle and come to a halt outside the front door. Dick watched as his wife climbed out of her car. "I'll see you at 8 tomorrow, Sam, and the Russian contract won't be the only thing on the agenda."
Dick's driver dropped him outside Sam Cohen's office in Lincoln's Inn Fields a few minutes before 8 the following morning. The senior partner rose to greet his client as he entered the room. He gestured to a comfortable chair on the other side of the desk. Dick had opened his briefcase even before he'd sat down. He took out the letter and passed it across to Sam. The lawyer read it slowly before placing it on the desk in front of him.
"I've thought about the problem overnight," said Sam. "And I also had a word with Anna Rentoul, our divorce partner. She's confirmed that Simons only handles matrimonial disputes, and with that in mind, I'm sorry to say that I'll have to ask you some fairly personal questions."
Dick nodded without comment.
"Have you ever discussed divorce with Maureen?"
"No," said Dick firmly.
"We've had rows from time to time, but then what couples have been together for over 20 years haven't?"
"No more than that."
"Well, she once threatened to leave me, but I thought that was all in the past." Dick paused. "I'm only surprised that she hasn't raised the subject with me before consulting a lawyer."
"That's all too common," said Sam.
"Over half the husbands who are served with a divorce petition claim they never saw it coming."
"I certainly fall into that category," admitted Dick.
"So what do I do next?"
"Not a lot you can do before she serves the writ, and I can't see that there's anything to be gained by raising the subject yourself. After all, nothing may come of it. However, that doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare ourselves. Now, what grounds could she have for divorce?"
"None that I can think of."
"Are you having an affair?"
"No."
Well, yes, a fling with my secretary, but it's not going anywhere. She thinks it's serious, but I plan to replace her once the pipeline contract is signed."
"So the deal is still on course," said Sam.
"Yes, that's originally why I needed to see you so urgently," replied Dick. "I have to be back in St. Petersburg for May the 16th, when both sides will be signing the contract."
He paused.
"And it's going to be witnessed by President Putin."
"Congratulations," said Sam.
"How much will that be worth to you?"
"Why do you ask?"
"I'm wondering if you're not the only person who's hoping that the deal will go through."
"Around 60 million.
Dick hesitated.
"For the company.
And do you still own 51% of the shares?"
"Yes, but I could always hide..."
"Don't even think about it," said Sam. "You won't be able to hide anything if Simons is on the case. He'll sniff out every last penny like a pig hunting for truffles. And if the court were to discover that you've attempted to deceive them, it would only make the judge more sympathetic to your wife."
The senior partner paused, looked directly at his client, and repeated, "Don't even think about it."
"So what should I do?"
"Nothing that will arouse suspicion. Go about your business as usual, as if you have no idea what she's up to. Meanwhile, I'll fix a consultation with counsel, so at least we'll be better prepared than Mr. Simons will be anticipating. And one more thing," said Sam, once again looking directly at his client. "No more extramarital activities until this problem has been resolved. That's an order." Dick kept a close eye on his wife during the next few days, but she gave no sign of there being anything untoward. If anything, she showed an unusual interest in how the trip to St. Petersburg had gone, and over dinner on Thursday evening even asked if the board had come to a decision.
"They most certainly have," Dick replied emphatically. "Once Sam had taken the directors through each clause, gone over every detail, and answered all of their questions, they virtually rubber-stamped the contract."
Dick poured himself a second cup of coffee. He was taken by surprise by his wife's next question.
"Why don't I join you when you go to St. Petersburg?" We could fly out on the Friday, she added, and spend the weekend visiting the Hermitage and the Summer Palace. We might even find enough time to see Catherine's amber collection, something I've always wanted to do. Dick didn't reply immediately, aware that this was not a casual suggestion, as it had been years since Maureen had accompanied him on a business trip. Dick's first reaction was to wonder what she was up to. "Let me think about it," he eventually responded, leaving his coffee to go cold. Dick rang Sam Cohen within minutes of arriving at his office and reported the conversation to his lawyer. "Simons must have advised her to witness the signing of the contract," suggested Cohen. "But why?" "So that Maureen will be able to claim that over the years she has played a leading role in your business success, always being there to support you at those critical moments in your career." "Balls," said Dick. "She's never taken any interest in how I make my money, only in how she can spend it." "And therefore, she must be entitled to 50% of your assets."
"But that could amount to over £30 million, Dick protested.
"Simons has obviously done his homework."
"Then I'll simply tell her that she can't come on the trip. It's not appropriate."
"Which will allow Mr. Simons to change tack. He'll then portray you as a heartless man who, the moment you became a success, cut his client out of your life, often travelling abroad, accompanied by a secretary who..." Okay, I get the picture. So allowing her to come to St. Petersburg might well prove to be the lesser of two evils. "On the one hand," counseled Sam.
"Bloody lawyers," said Dick before he could finish the sentence.
"Funny how you only need us when you're in trouble," Sam rejoined. "So let's make sure that this time we anticipate her next move. And what's that likely to be?" "Once she's got you to St. Petersburg, she'll want to have sex." "We haven't had sex for years."
"And not because I haven't wanted to, my lord." "Oh, hell," said Dick. "I can't win."
"You can, as long as you don't follow Lady Longford's advice. When asked if she had ever considered divorcing Lord Longford, she replied, 'Divorce, never. Murder, often.'" Mr. and Mrs. Richard Barnsley checked into the Grand Palace Hotel in St. Petersburg a fortnight later. A porter placed their bags on a trolley and then accompanied them to the Tolstoy suite on the 9th floor. "I must go to the loo before I burst," said Dick, as he rushed into the room ahead of his wife. While her husband disappeared into the bathroom, Maureen looked out of the window and admired the golden domes of St. Nicholas's Cathedral. Once he'd locked the door, Dick removed the "Don't drink the water" sign that was perched on the washbasin and tucked it into the back pocket of his trousers. Next, he unscrewed the tops of the two Evian bottles and poured the contents down the sink. He then refilled both bottles with tap water, before screwing the tops firmly back on and returning them to their place on the corner of the basin. He unlocked the door and strolled out of the bathroom. Dick started to unpack his suitcase, but stopped the moment Maureen disappeared into the bathroom. First, he transferred the "Don't drink the water" sign from his back pocket into the side flap of his suitcase. He zipped up the flap before checking round the room. There was a small bottle of Evian water on each side of the bed, and two large bottles on the table by the window. He grabbed the bottle by his wife's side of the bed and retreated into the kitchenette at the far end of the room. Dick poured the contents down the sink and refilled the bottle with tap water. He then returned it to Maureen's side of the bed. Next, he took the two large bottles from the table by the window and repeated the process. By the time his wife had come out of the bathroom, Dick had almost finished unpacking. While Maureen continued to unpack her suitcase, Dick strolled across to his side of the bed and dialed a number he didn't need to look up. As he waited for the phone to be answered, he opened the bottle of Evian water on his side of the bed and took a gulp. "Hi, Anatole, it's Dick Barnsley. I thought I'd let you know that we've just checked into the Grand Palace."
"Welcome back to St. Petersburg," said a friendly voice. "And is your wife with you on this occasion?"
"She most certainly is," replied Dick, "and very much looking forward to meeting you."
"Me too," said the minister.
So make sure that you have a relaxed weekend, because everything is set up for Monday morning. The president is due to fly in tomorrow night, so he'll be present when the contract is signed.
10 o'clock at the Winter Palace?
10 o'clock,
repeated Chenkov.
I'll pick you up from your hotel at 9. It's only a 30-minute drive, but we can't afford to be late for this one.
I'll be waiting for you in the lobby, said Dick. See you then. He put the phone down and turned to his wife.
Why don't we go down to dinner, my darling? We've got a long day ahead of us tomorrow.
He adjusted his watch by 3 hours and added,
So perhaps it would be wise to have an early night.
Maureen placed a long silk nightdress on her side of the bed and smiled in agreement. As she turned to place her empty case in the wardrobe, Dick slipped an Evian bottle from the bedside table into his jacket pocket. He then accompanied his wife down to the dining room. The head waiter guided them to a quiet table in the corner, and, once they were seated, offered his two guests menus. Maureen disappeared behind the large leather cover while she considered the table d'hôte, which allowed Dick enough time to remove the bottle of Evian from his pocket, undo the cap, and fill his wife's glass. Once they had both selected their meals, Maureen went over her proposed itinerary for the next 2 days.
I think we should begin with the Hermitage, first thing in the morning, she suggested. Take a break for lunch and then spend the rest of the afternoon at the Summer Palace.
What about the amber collection? Asked Dick, as he topped up her water glass. I thought that was a no-miss.
I'd already scheduled in the amber collection and the Russian Museum for Sunday.
Sounds as if you have everything well organized, said Dick,
as a waiter placed a bowl of borscht in front of his wife. Maureen spent the rest of the meal telling Dick about some of the treasures that they would see when they visited the Hermitage. By the time Dick had signed the bill, Maureen had drunk the bottle of water. Dick slipped the empty bottle back in his pocket. Once they had returned to their room, he filled it with tap water and left it in the bathroom. By the time Dick had undressed and climbed into bed, Maureen was still studying her guidebook.
Oh, I feel exhausted, Dick said. It must be the time change.
He turned his back on her, hoping she wouldn't work out that it was just after 8 p.m. in England. Dick woke the following morning feeling very thirsty. He looked at the empty bottle of Evian on his side of the bed and remembered just in time. He climbed out of bed, walked across to the fridge, and selected a bottle of orange juice.
"Will you be going to the gym this morning?" he asked a half-wake Maureen.
"Do I have time?"
"Sure. The Hermitage doesn't open till 10, and one of the reasons I always stay here is because of the hotel's gym."
"So what about you?"
"I still have to make some phone calls if everything is to be set up for Monday."
Maureen slipped out of bed and disappeared into the bathroom, which allowed Dick enough time to top up her glass and replace the empty bottle of Evian on her side of the bed. When Maureen emerged a few minutes later, she checked her watch before slipping on her gym kit.
"I shall be back in about 40 minutes, she said, after tying up her trainers.
Don't forget to take some water with you, said Dick,
handing her one of the bottles from the table by the window. They may not have one in the gym.
Thank you, she said.
Dick wondered from the expression on her face if he was being just a little too solicitous. While Maureen was in the gym, Dick took a shower. When he walked back into the bedroom, he was pleased to see that the sun was shining. He put on a blazer and slacks, but only after he checked that none of the bottles had been replaced by the hotel staff while he'd been in the bathroom. Dick ordered breakfast for both of them, which arrived moments after Maureen returned from the gym, clutching the half-empty Evian bottle.
"How did your training go?" Dick asked.
"Not great," Maureen replied. "I felt a bit listless."
"Probably just jet lag," suggested Dick as he took his place on the far side of the table.
He poured his wife a glass of water and himself another orange juice. Dick opened a copy of the Herald Tribune, which he began to read while he waited for his wife to dress. Hillary Clinton said she wouldn't be running for president, which only convinced Dick that she would, especially as she made the announcement standing by her husband's side. Maureen came out of the bathroom wearing a hotel dressing gown.
She took the seat opposite her husband and sipped the water.
"Better take a bottle of Evian with us when we visit the Hermitage," said Maureen.
Dick looked up from behind his paper.
"The girl in the gym warned me not under any circumstances to drink the local water."
"Oh, yes, I should have warned you," said Dick, as Maureen took a bottle from the table by the window and put it in her bag. "Can't be too careful."
Dick and Maureen strolled through the front gates of the Hermitage a few minutes before 10 to find themselves at the back of a long queue. The crocodile of visitors progressed slowly forward along an unshaded cobbled path. Maureen took several sips of water between turning the pages of the guidebook. It was 10:40 before they reached the ticket booth. Once inside, Maureen continued to study her guidebook.
"Whatever we do, we must be sure to see Michelangelo's Crouching Boy, Raphael's Virgin, and Leonardo's Madonna Benoit."
Dick smiled his agreement, but knew he wouldn't be concerning himself with the masters. As they climbed the wide marble staircase, they passed several magnificent statues nestled in alcoves. Dick was surprised to discover just how vast the Hermitage was. Despite visiting St. Petersburg several times during the past 3 years, he had only ever seen the building from the outside.
"Housed on 3 floors, Tsar Peter's collection displays treasures in over 200 rooms, Maureen told him, reading from the guidebook. "So, let's get started."
By 11:30, they had only covered the Dutch and Italian schools on the first floor, by which time Maureen had finished the large bottle of Evian. Dick volunteered to go and buy another bottle. He left his wife admiring Caravaggio's The Lute Player while he slipped into the nearest restroom. He refilled the empty Evian bottle with tap water before rejoining his wife. If Maureen had spent a little time studying one of the many drinks counters situated on each floor, she would have discovered that the Hermitage doesn't stock Evian because it has an exclusive contract with Volvic. By 12:30, they had all but covered the 16 rooms devoted to the Renaissance artists and agreed it was time for lunch. They left the building and strolled back into the midday sun. The two of them walked for a while along the bank of the Moika River, stopping only to take a photograph of a bride and groom posing on the blue bridge in front of the Marinsky Palace.
"A local tradition," said Maureen, turning another page of her guidebook.
After walking another block, they came to a halt outside a small pizzeria. Its sensible square tables with neat red and white checked tablecloths and smartly dressed waiters tempted them inside.
"I must go to the loo," said Maureen. "I'm feeling a little queasy. Must be the heat."
She added, "Just order me a salad and a glass of water." Dick smiled, removed the Evian bottle from her bag, and filled up the glass on her side of the table. When the waiter appeared, Dick ordered a salad for his wife and ravioli plus a large Diet Coke for himself. He was desperate for something to drink. Once she'd eaten her salad, Maureen perked up a little and even began to tell Dick what they should look out for when they visited the Summer Palace. On the long taxi ride through the north of the city, she continued to read extracts from her guidebook. Peter the Great built the Summer Palace after he had visited Versailles, and on returning to Russia employed the finest landscape gardeners and most gifted craftsmen in the land to reproduce the French masterpiece. He intended the finished work to be a homage to the French, whom he greatly admired as the leaders of style throughout Europe. The taxi driver interrupted her flow with a snippet of information of his own.
"We are just passing the recently constructed Winter Palace, which is where President Putin stays whenever he's in St. Petersburg."
The driver paused.
"And as the national flag is flying, he must be in town. He's flown down from Moscow, especially to see me," said Dick.
The taxi driver dutifully laughed.
The taxi drove through the gates of the Summer Palace half an hour later, and the driver dropped his passengers off in a crowded car park, bustling with sightseers and traders who were standing behind their makeshift stalls plying their cheap souvenirs.
"Let's go and see the real thing," suggested Maureen.
"I wait for you here,"
said the taxi driver. No extra charge. How long? He added. I should think we'd be a couple of hours, said Dick. No more. I wait for you. Here, he repeated. The two of them strolled around the magnificent gardens, and Dick could see why it was described in the guidebooks as a can't-afford-to-miss with 5 stars. Maureen continued to brief him between sips of water. The grounds surrounding the palace cover over 100 acres with more than 20 fountains as well as 11 other palatial residences. Although the sun was no longer burning down, the sky was still clear, and Maureen continued to take regular gulps of water. But however many times she offered the bottle to Dick, he always replied, "No thanks." When they finally climbed the steps of the palace, they were greeted by another long queue, and Maureen admitted that she was feeling a little tired. "Pity to have travelled this far," said Dick, "and not take a look inside." His wife reluctantly agreed. When they reached the front of the queue, Dick purchased 2 entrance tickets and, for a small extra charge, selected an English-speaking guide to show them around. "I don't feel too good," said Maureen as they entered the Empress Catherine's bedroom. She clung onto the 4-poster bed. "You must drink lots of water on such a hot day," suggested the tour guide helpfully. By the time they had reached Tsar Nicholas IV's study, Maureen warned her husband that she thought she was going to faint. Dick apologized to their guide, put an arm around his wife's shoulder, and assisted her out of the palace on an unsteady journey back to the car park. They found their taxi driver standing by his car waiting for them. "We must return to the Grand Palace Hotel immediately," said Dick, as his wife fell into the back seat of the car like a drunk who has been thrown out of a pub on a Saturday night. On the long drive back to St. Petersburg, Maureen was violently sick in the back of the taxi, but the driver didn't comment, just maintained a steady speed as he continued along the highway. 40 minutes later, he came to a halt outside the Grand Palace Hotel. Dick handed over a wadge of notes and apologized. "Hope Madam better soon," he said. "Yes, let's hope so," replied Dick. Dick helped his wife out of the back of the car and guided her up the steps into the hotel lobby and quickly towards the lifts, not wishing to draw attention to himself. He had her safely back in their suite moments later. Maureen immediately disappeared into the bathroom, and even with the door closed, Dick could hear her retching. He searched around the room. In their absence, all the bottles of Evian had been replaced. He only bothered to empty the one by Maureen's bedside, which he refilled with tap water from the kitchenette. Maureen finally emerged from the bathroom and collapsed onto the bed. "I feel awful," she said. "Perhaps you ought to take a couple of aspirin and try to get some sleep." Maureen nodded weakly. "Could you fetch them for me? They're in my wash bag." "Of course, my darling." Once he'd found the pills, he filled a glass with tap water before returning to his wife's side. She had taken off her dress, but not her slip. Dick helped her to sit up and became aware for the first time that she was soaked in sweat. She swilled down the 2 aspirins with a glass of water Dick offered her. He lowered her gently down onto the pillow before drawing the curtains. He then strolled across to the bedroom door, opened it, and placed the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob. The last thing he needed was for a solicitous maid to come barging in and find his wife in her present state. Once Dick was certain she was asleep, he went down to dinner. "Will Madame be joining you this evening?" inquired the head waiter, once Dick was seated. "No, sadly not," replied Dick. "She has a slight migraine, too much sun, I fear, but I'm sure she'll be fine by the morning." "Let's hope so, sir. What can I interest you in tonight?" Dick took his time perusing the menu before he eventually said, "I think I'll start with the foie gras, followed by a rump steak." He paused. "Medium rare." "Excellent choice, sir." Dick poured himself a glass of water from the bottle on the table and quickly gulped it down before filling his glass a second time. He didn't hurry his meal, and when he returned to his suite just after 10, he was delighted to find his wife was fast asleep. He picked up her glass, took it to the bathroom, and refilled it with tap water.
He then put it back on her side of the bed. Dick took his time undressing before finally slipping under the covers to settle down next to his wife. He turned out the bedside light and slept soundly. When Dick woke the following morning, he found that he, too, was covered in sweat. The sheets were also soaked, and when he turned over to look at his wife, all the colour had drained from her cheeks. Dick eased himself out of bed, slipped into the bathroom, and took a long shower. Once he had dried himself, he put on one of the hotel's toweling dressing gowns and returned to the bedroom. He crept over to his wife's side of the bed, and once again refilled her empty glass with tap water. She had clearly awoken during the night, but not disturbed him. He drew the curtains before checking that the Do Not Disturb sign was still on the door. He returned to his wife's side of the bed, pulled up a chair, and began to read the Herald Tribune. He had reached the sports pages by the time she woke. Her words were slurred. She managed, "I feel awful." A long pause followed before she added, "Don't you think I ought to see a doctor?" "He's already been to examine you, my dear," said Dick. "I called for him last night, don't you remember? He told you that you'd caught a fever and you'll just have to sweat it out." "Did he leave any pills?" asked Maureen, plaintively. "No, my darling, he just said you weren't to eat anything but to try and drink as much water as possible." He held the glass up to her lips, and she attempted to gulp some more down. She even managed, "Thank you," before collapsing back onto the pillow. "Don't worry, my darling," said Dick. "You're going to be just fine, and I promise you, I won't leave your side even for a moment." He leant over and kissed her on the forehead. She fell asleep again. The only time Dick left Maureen's side that day was to assure the housekeeper that his wife did not wish to have the sheets changed, to refill the glass of water on her bedside table, and, late in the afternoon, to take a call from the minister.
"The president flew in yesterday," were Chenkov's opening words. "He's staying at the Winter Palace where I've just left him. He wanted me to let you know how much he's looking forward to meeting you and your wife."
"How kind of him," said Dick, "but I have a problem."
"A problem?"
said a man who didn't like problems, especially when the president was in town. "It's just that Maureen seems to have caught a fever. We were out in the sun all day yesterday, and I'm not sure that she will have fully recovered in time to join us for the signing ceremony, so I may be on my own."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Chenkov. "And how are you?"
"Never felt better," said Dick.
"That's good,"
said Chenkov, sounding relieved.
"So I'll pick you up at 9 o'clock, as agreed. I don't want to keep the president waiting."
"Neither do I, Anatole," Dick assured him. "You'll find me standing in the lobby long before 9. There was a knock on the door. Dick quickly put the phone down and rushed across to open it before anyone was given a chance to barge in. A maid was standing in the corridor next to a trolley laden with sheets, towels, bars of soap, shampoo bottles, and cases of Evian water.
"You want the bed turned down, sir?"
she asked, giving him a smile.
"No, thank you," said Dick. "My wife is not feeling well."
He pointed to the Do Not Disturb sign.
"More water, perhaps?"
she suggested, holding up a large bottle of Evian. "No," he repeated firmly, and closed the door. The only other call that evening came from the hotel manager. He asked politely if Madam would like to see the hotel doctor.
"No, thank you," said Dick. "She just caught a little sun, but she's on the mend, and I feel sure she will have fully recovered by the morning." "Just give me a call," said the manager, "should she change her mind. The doctor can be with you in minutes."
"That's very considerate of you," said Dick, "but it won't be necessary," he added, before putting the phone down. He returned to his wife's side. Her skin was now pallid and blotchy. He leant forward until he was almost touching her lips. She was still breathing. He walked across to the fridge, opened it, and took out all the unopened bottles of Evian water. He placed two of them in the bathroom and one each side of the bed. His final action, before undressing, was to take the "Don't drink the water" sign out of his suitcase and replace it on the side of the wash basin. Chenkov's car pulled up outside the Grand Palace Hotel a few minutes before 9 the following morning. Karl jumped out to open the back door for the minister. Chenkov walked quickly up the steps and into the hotel, expecting to find Dick waiting for him in the lobby. He looked up and down the crowded corridor, but there was no sign of his business partner. He marched across to the reception desk and asked if Mr. Barnsley had left a message for him.
"No, Minister," replied the concierge. "Would you like me to call his room?"
The minister nodded briskly. They both waited for some time before the concierge added,
"No one is answering the phone, Minister, so perhaps Mr. Barnsley is on his way down."
Chenkov nodded again and began pacing up and down the lobby, continually glancing towards the elevator before checking his watch. At 9:10, the minister became even more anxious, as he had no desire to keep the president waiting. He returned to the reception desk.
"Try again," he demanded.
The concierge immediately dialed Mr. Barnsley's room number, but could only report that there was still no reply.
"Send for the manager,"
barked the minister. The concierge nodded, picked up the phone once again, and dialed a single number. A few moments later, a tall, elegantly dressed man in a dark suit was standing by Chenkov's side.
"How may I assist you, Minister?" he asked.
"I need to go up to Mr. Barnsley's room."
"Of course, Minister. Please follow me."
When the three men arrived on the 9th floor, they quickly made their way to the Tolstoy suite, where they found the Do Not Disturb sign hanging from the doorknob. The minister banged loudly on the door, but there was no response.
"Open the door," he demanded.
The concierge obeyed without hesitation. The minister marched into the room, followed by the manager and the concierge. Chenkov came to an abrupt halt when he saw two motionless bodies lying in bed. The concierge didn't need to be told to call for a doctor. Sadly, the doctor had attended 3 such cases in the past month, but with a difference. They had all been locals. He studied his 2 patients for some time before he passed a judgment.
"The Siberian disease," he confirmed, almost in a whisper.
He paused, and looking up at the minister, added,
"The lady undoubtedly died during the night, whereas the gentleman has passed away within the last hour."
The minister made no comment.
"My initial conclusion," continued the doctor, "is that she probably caught the disease from drinking too much of the local water."
He paused as he looked down at Dick's lifeless body.
"While her husband must have contracted the virus from his wife, probably during the night. Not an uncommon occurrence among married couples," he added. "Like so many of our countrymen, he clearly wasn't aware that..."
He hesitated before uttering the word in front of the minister.
"Siberius is one of those rare diseases that is not only infectious, but highly contagious." "But I called him last night," protested the manager, "and asked if he'd like to see a doctor, and he said it wasn't necessary as his wife was on the mend, and he was confident that she would be fully recovered by the morning." "How sad," said the doctor, before adding, "If only he'd said yes, it would have been too late to revive his wife. But I still might have saved him."
4. It can't be October already. Patrick O'Flynn stood in front of H. Samuel, the jeweller's, holding a brick in his right hand. He was staring intently at the window. He smiled, raised his arm, and hurled the brick at the glass pane. The window shattered like a spider's web, but remained firmly in place. An alarm was immediately set off, which in the still of a clear, cold October night could be heard half a mile away. More important to Pat, the alarm was directly connected to the local police station. Pat didn't move as he continued to stare at his handiwork. He only had to wait 90 seconds before he heard the sound of a siren in the distance. He bent down and retrieved the brick from the pavement as the whining noise grew louder and louder. When the police car came to a screeching halt by the curbside, Pat raised the brick above his head and leant back like an Olympic javelin thrower intent on a gold medal. Two policemen leapt out of the car. The older one ignored Pat, who remained poised, arm above his head, with the brick in his hand, and walked across to the window to check the damage. Although the pane was shattered, it was still firmly in place. In any case, an iron security grill had descended behind the window, something Pat knew full well would happen. But when the sergeant returned to the station, he would still have to phone the manager, get him out of bed, and ask him to come down to the shop and turn off the alarm. The sergeant turned round to find Pat still standing with the brick high above his head.
"Okay, Pat, hand it over and get in," said the sergeant, as he held open the back door of the police car.
Pat smiled, passed the brick to the fresh-faced constable, and said, "You'll need this as evidence." The young constable was speechless.
"Thank you, Sergeant," said Pat,
as he climbed into the back of the car, and smiling at the young constable who took his place behind the wheel, asked,
"Have I ever told you about the time I tried to get a job on a building site in Liverpool?"
"Many times," interjected the sergeant as he took his place next to Pat and pulled the back door closed.
"No handcuffs?" queried Pat.
"I don't want to be handcuffed to you," said the sergeant. "I want to be rid of you. Why don't you just go back to Ireland?"
"An altogether inferior class of prison," Pat explained. "And in any case, they don't treat me with the same degree of respect as you do, Sergeant," he added,
as the car moved away from the curb and headed back towards the police station.
"Can you tell me your name?"
Pat asked, leaning forward to address the young constable.
Constable Cooper."
"Are you by any chance related to Chief Inspector Cooper?"
"He's my father."
"A gentleman," said Pat. "We've had many a cup of tea and biscuits together. I hope he's in fine fettle."
"He's just retired," said Constable Cooper.
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Pat. "Will you tell him that Pat O'Flynn asked after him, and please send him and your dear mother my best wishes?"
"Stop taking a piss, Pat," said the sergeant.
"The boy's only been out of Peel House for a few weeks,"
he added as the car came to a halt outside the police station. The sergeant climbed out of the back and held the door open for Pat.
"Thank you, Sergeant,"
said Pat, as if he was addressing the doorman at the Ritz. The constable grinned as the sergeant accompanied Pat up the stairs and into the police station.
"Ah, and a very good evening to you, Mr. Breaker,"
said Pat, when he saw who it was standing behind the desk.
"Oh, Christ," said the duty sergeant.
"It can't be October already." "I'm afraid so, Sergeant," said Pat. "I was wondering if my usual cell is available. I'll only be staying overnight, you understand."
"I'm afraid not," said the desk sergeant. "It's already occupied by a real criminal. You'll have to be satisfied with cell number two."
"But I've always had cell number one in the past," protested Pat.
The desk sergeant looked up and raised an eyebrow.
"No, I'm to blame," admitted Pat. "I should have asked my secretary to call and book in advance. You need to take an imprint of my credit card."
"No, I have all your details on file," the desk sergeant assured him.
"How about fingerprints?"
"Unless you found a way of removing your old ones, Pat, I don't think we need another set, but I suppose you'd better sign the charge sheet."
Pat took the proffered biro and signed on the bottom line with a flourish.
"Take him down to cell number two, Constable."
"Thank you, Sergeant,"
said Pat as he was led away. He stopped, turned around and said,
I wonder, Sergeant, if you could give me a wake-up call around 7, a cup of tea, Earl Grey, preferably, and a copy of the Irish Times."
"Piss off, Pat,"
said the desk sergeant, as the constable tried to stifle a laugh.
"Which reminds me," said Pat, "have I told you about the time I tried to get a job on a building site in Liverpool, and the foreman..."
"Get him out of my sight, Constable, if you don't want to spend the rest of the month on traffic duty."
The constable grabbed Pat by the elbow and hurried him downstairs.
No need to come with me, said Pat. I can find me own way.
This time the constable did laugh as he placed a key in the lock of cell number 2. The young policeman unlocked the cell and pulled open the heavy door, allowing Pat to stroll in.
Thank you, Constable Cooper, said Pat. I look forward to seeing you in the morning.
I'll be off duty, said Constable Cooper.
Then I'll see you this time next year, said Pat,
without explanation.
And don't forget to pass on my best wishes to your father,
he added, as the 4-inch-thick iron door was slammed shut. Pat studied the cell for a few moments. A steel washbasin, a bog and a bed, one sheet, one blanket, and one pillow. Pat was reassured by the fact that nothing had changed since last year. He fell on the horsehair mattress, placed his head on the rock-hard pillow, and slept all night, for the first time in weeks. Pat was woken from a deep sleep at 7 the following morning when the cell door flap was flicked open and 2 black eyes stared in.
Good morning, Pat, said a friendly voice. Good morning, Wesley, said Pat,
not even opening his eyes.
And how are you?
I'm well, replied Wesley. But sorry to see you back.
He paused.
I suppose it must be October.
It certainly is, said Pat, climbing off the bed. And it's important that I look my best for this morning's show trial. Anything you need in particular? A cup of tea would be most acceptable, but what I really require is a razor, a bar of soap, a toothbrush, and some toothpaste. I don't have to remind you, Wesley, that a defendant is entitled to this simple request before he makes an appearance in court.
I'll see you get them, said Wesley. And would you like to read my copy of The Sun?
That's kind of you, Wesley, but if the chief superintendent has finished with yesterday's Times, I'd prefer that.
A West Indian chuckle was followed by the closing of the shutter on the cell door. Pat didn't have to wait long before he heard a key turn in the lock. The heavy door was pulled open to reveal the smiling face of Wesley Pickett, a tray in one hand which he placed on the end of the bed.
Thank you, Wesley,
said Pat as he stared down at the bowl of cornflakes, small carton of skimmed milk, 2 slices of burnt toast and a boiled egg.
I do hope Molly remembered, added Pat, that I like me eggs lightly boiled for 2.5 minutes.
Molly left last year, said Wesley. I think you'll find the egg was boiled last night by the desk sergeant.
You can't get the staff nowadays, said Pat. I blame it on the Irish myself. They're no longer committed to domestic service, he added as he tapped the top of his egg with a plastic spoon. Wesley, have I told you about the time I tried to get a labouring job on a building site in Liverpool and the foreman, a bloody Englishman?
Pat looked up and sighed as he heard the door slam and the key turn in the lock.
I suppose I must have told him the story before, he muttered to himself.
After Pat had finished breakfast, he cleaned his teeth with a toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste that were even smaller than the ones they'd supplied on his only experience of an Aer Lingus flight to Dublin. Next, he turned on the hot tap in the tiny steel washbasin. The slow trickle of water took some time to turn from cold to lukewarm. He rubbed the mean piece of soap between his fingers until he'd whipped up enough cream to produce a lather, which he then smeared all over his stubbled face. Next he picked up the plastic Bic razor and began the slow process of removing a 4-day-old stubble. He finally dabbed his face with a rough green hand towel, not much larger than a flannel. Pat sat on the end of the bed and, while he waited, read Wesley's Sun from cover to cover in 4 minutes. Only an article by their political editor, Trevor Kavanagh, he must surely be an Irishman, thought Pat, was worthy of his attention. Pat's thoughts were interrupted when the heavy metal door was pulled open once again.
Nesby Avenue, Pat, said Sergeant Webster. You're first on this morning.
Pat accompanied the officer back up the stairs, and when he saw the desk sergeant, asked,
Could I have me valuables back, Mr. Baker? You'll find them in the safe.
Like what?
Said the desk sergeant, looking up.
My pearl cufflinks, the Cartier tank watch, and a silver-topped cane engraved with my family crest.
I flogged them all off last night, Pat,
said the desk sergeant.
Probably for the best, remarked Pat.
I won't be needing them where I'm going," he added, before following Sergeant Webster out of the front door and onto the pavement.
"Jump in the front," said the sergeant, as he climbed behind the wheel of a panda car.
"But I'm entitled to two officers to escort me to court," insisted Pat. "It's a Home Office regulation."
"It may well be a Home Office regulation," the sergeant replied, "but we're short-staffed this morning, two off sick and one away on a training course."
"But what if I try to escape?"
"A blessed release," said Sergeant Webster, as he pulled away from the curb, "because that would save us all a lot of trouble."
"And what would you do if I decided to punch you?"
"I'll punch you back," said an exasperated sergeant.
"That's not very friendly," suggested Pat.
"Sorry, Pat," said the sergeant. "It's just that I promised my wife that I'd be off duty by 10 this morning so we could go shopping." He paused. "So she won't be best pleased with me, or you, for that matter."
"I apologise, Sergeant Webster," said Pat. "Next October I'll try to find out which shift you're on, so I can be sure to avoid it. Perhaps you'd pass on my apologies to Mrs. Webster."
The sergeant would have laughed if it had been anyone else, but he knew Pat meant it.
"Any idea who I'll be up in front of this morning?"
asked Pat as the car came to a halt at a set of traffic lights. "Thursday," said the sergeant as the lights turned green and he pushed the gear lever back into first. "It must be Perkins."
"Councillor Arnold Perkins, OBE. Oh, good," said Pat. "He's got a very short fuse, so if he doesn't give me a long enough sentence, I'll just have to light it,"
he added as the car swung into the private car park at the back of Marylebone Road Magistrates Court. A court officer was heading towards the police car just as Pat stepped out.
"Good morning, Mr. Adams," said Pat.
"When I looked at the list of defendants this morning, Pat, and saw your name," said Mr. Adams, "I assumed it must be that time of the year when you make your annual appearance. Follow me, Pat, and let's get this over with as quickly as possible." Pat accompanied Mr. Adams through the back door of the courthouse and on down the long corridor to a holding cell.
"Thank you, Mr. Adams,"
said Pat as he took a seat on a thin wooden bench that was cemented to a wall along one side of the large oblong room.
"If you'd be kind enough to just leave me for a few moments," Pat added, "so that I can compose myself before the curtain goes up."
Mr. Adams smiled and turned to leave.
"By the way," said Pat, as Mr. Adams touched the handle of the door, "did I tell you about the time I tried to get a labouring job on a building site in Liverpool, but the foreman, a bloody Englishman, had the nerve to ask me—"
"Sorry, Pat, some of us have a job to do, and in any case, you told me that story last October." He paused.
"And come to think of it, the October before."
Pat sat silently on the bench, and as he had nothing else to read, considered the graffiti on the wall. "Perkins is a Pratt." He felt able to agree with that sentiment. "Man U are the champions." Someone had crossed out Man U and replaced it with Chelsea. Pat wondered if he should cross out Chelsea and write in Cork, whom neither team had ever defeated. As there was no clock on the wall, Pat couldn't be sure how much time had passed before Mr. Adams finally returned to escort him up to the courtroom. Adams was now dressed in a long black gown, looking like Pat's old headmaster. "Follow me," Mr. Adams intoned solemnly. Pat remained unusually silent as they proceeded down the yellow brick road, as the old lags call the last few yards before you climb the steps and enter the back door of the court. Pat ended up standing in the dock with a bailiff by his side. Pat stared up at the bench and looked at the three magistrates who made up this morning's panel. Something was wrong. He had been expecting to see Mr. Perkins, who had been bald this time last year, almost Pickwickian. Now, suddenly, he seemed to have sprouted a head of fair hair. On his right was Councillor Steadman, a Liberal who was much too lenient for Pat's liking. On the chairman's left sat a middle-aged lady whom Pat had never seen before. Her thin lips and piggy eyes gave Pat a little confidence that the Liberal could be outvoted 2-1, especially if he played his cards right. Miss Piggy looked as if she would have happily supported capital punishment for shoplifters. Sergeant Webster stepped into the witness box and took the oath.
"What can you tell us about this case, Sergeant?" Mr. Perkins asked, once the oath had been administered.
"May I refer to my notes, Your Honour?" asked Sergeant Webster, turning to face the chairman of the panel. Mr. Perkins nodded, and the sergeant turned over the cover of his notepad.
I apprehended the defendant at 2 o'clock this morning after he had thrown a brick at the window of H. Samuel the Jeweller's on Mason Street.
Did you see him throw the brick, Sergeant?
No, I did not, admitted Webster. But he was standing on the pavement with the brick in his hand when I apprehended him.
And had he managed to gain entry? Asked Perkins.
No, sir, said the sergeant. But he was about to throw the brick again when I arrested him.
The same brick?
I think so. And had he done any damage? It shattered the glass, but a security grill prevented him from removing anything.
How valuable were the goods in the window? Asked Mr. Perkins.
There were no goods in the window, replied the sergeant, because the manager always locks them up in the safe before going home at night.
Mr. Perkins looked puzzled and, glancing down at the charge sheet, said, I see you have charged O'Flynn with attempting to break and enter.
That is correct, sir,
said Sergeant Webster, returning his notebook to a back pocket of his trousers. Mr. Perkins turned his attention to Pat.
I note that you have entered a plea of guilty on the charge sheet, O'Flynn.
Yes, my lord.
Then I'll have to sentence you to 3 months unless you can offer some explanation.
He paused and looked down at Pat over the top of his half-moon spectacles.
Do you wish to make a statement? He asked.
3 months is not enough, my lord.
I am not a lord, said Mr. Perkins firmly.
Oh, aren't you? Said Pat. It's just that I thought as you were wearing a wig, which you didn't have this time last year, you must be a lord.
Watch your tongue, said Mr. Perkins, or I may have to consider putting your sentence up to 6 months.
That's more like it, my lord, said Pat.
If that's more like it, said Mr. Perkins, barely able to control his